Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Jim and Austin, welcome this morning. We've had a lot of talk on the site about China and what's going on in China. And Jim, you just wrote an article recently called China Buys Cambodia, I think. And there was a nice statement in that article about China being involved with all the rogue nations, Myanmar and Iran and anybody else that you can probably put on that list. What is their goal in all of this? And first of all, why have they gotten so involved in Cambodia again? I mean, Cambodia has just been basically floating there as almost a non-state for the last 20 years.
Well, China is not one entity. There are basically two things going on in China. One is the people who run the country. It's the largest communist police state left on the planet. The other communist police states being North Korea, Cuba, who's the other one? Not Iran, that's a religious police state. Anyway, China has this government, this Communist Party, which is desperately trying to hang on to power. But then you have most Chinese who just want to have a better life. So the Chinese Communist government makes all these allies, partly to have allies, which is always nice, and Cambodia is a non-entity as an ally. It's just, handy. The only relationship, China has had with Cambodia is a rather, uncomplimentary one. China supported Pol Pot, the guy who exterminated about, 20% of the Cambodians as he tried to establish a perfect communist state in the 1970s. He was run out of power by the Vietnamese, who have never gotten along with the Chinese. Except when desperate, like when they were fighting us in the 60s. And then, China invaded North Vietnam for that and other reasons in the late, in 1979. So China is a government that will do crazy things to stay in power, like pushing nationalism. Now, you'd think you don't really have to push nationalism. Just look at the World Cup. Every 4 years you got instant nationalism. But China needs it all the time, not just every 4 years, which is why they put on that big show for the Olympics, why they even went and, spent all that money to get the Olympics, and why they lavish all this money on the military, why they spend so much money developing their own weapons when they could, more cheaply, inexpensively buy them from somebody else. All this plays into this sense of nationalism, which the ruling party, the Communist Party, takes credit for, all these accomplishments, and let the people love them. The trouble is that people don't love them. People hate them. A recent example of that, which really isn't in our purview, is there was a big strike at a Honda parts factory in China recently. Now, there's not supposed to be strikes in China. It's the workers' paradise, officially. And there are government-sanctioned unions whose main function is to keep the workers under control, not to serve the workers. But, that's the way it works in communist countries. But the workers took advantage of the new communications tools, mainly cell phones, the internet, even though it's heavily monitored in China, and they basically set up their own communications network and, circumvented the official bureaucracy, including the official union completely, and got this strike organized and kept it going. The government had to back down. What really bothers the government is these communications techniques are all over the place now. And the government wants to avoid a direct confrontation with their people. So they're basically doing all sorts of crazy things, like, becoming buddies with Cambodia, in order to avoid confronting their own people, whom they've basically been treating, not as shabbily as the Russians did, but, pretty badly. Before they changed their tactics in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, they had killed like 30, 40 million Chinese. That was mostly under Mao. And the Chinese have, they remember these things. They had Tiananmen Square in 89. Relations between the Chinese government and the Chinese people have never been good historically. And the current Chinese government doesn't want it to get any worse so they can stay in power. Because let's face it, they're all getting rich. One reason they let the economy go market style instead of, state regulated in the 1980s was to basically avoid the fate that was then overtaking Russia. In other words, economic collapse. The centrally controlled economy simply doesn't work, or nobody's been able to make it work yet, which is what academic Marxists will tell you. You know, real communism hasn't been invented yet. We're still working on the techniques. We got mass murder down, but controlling the economy is still a little beyond us, but just give us time. So the communist government is basically pursuing a dream where the people are pursuing something more concrete. And this is what creates a lot of the weird stuff you see coming out of China. The weird things the government is doing versus the very pragmatic things the people are doing. I mean, a lot of manufactured goods are coming out of China increasingly, and increasingly they're fairly high tech. Your iPhone comes from China, or most of your iPods come from China. An increasing amount of your computer equipment comes from China. So they are not back in the dark ages as far as manufacturing goes. There's a lot of high-tech stuff they can't do. They can't do aircraft engines, but very few countries have an aircraft engine, capability. They're not at the bleeding edge of computer developments, although they have the second fastest supercomputer in the world as of a month or so ago. Their space program is still, back in the 1970s somewhere. But when you consider that they were nowhere, they were hardly on the map at all, 30 years ago, they've made enormous progress. And this is what makes them scary, because people listen to what the Chinese government is saying about, we will be a power to reckon with, et cetera, et cetera. And ignoring the fact that the Chinese people just want to, have a better life.
Yeah. What is the rest of the world's take on China, Austin, as they take a look at what's going on, outside the way we look at them? How are the rest of the countries trying to deal with them, and are they as nervous about some of the stuff they're doing as our military and our national security apparatus is?
Well, we're going to have to divide the world up to answer your question. We're going to have to talk about nations that are on China's borders, and I'll give you a little tour here in a minute. As a matter of fact, I think I'm going to do this in a upcoming column, which will show up on Point. I did it once, really almost a decade ago. It's time to update the tour of China's borders. But let's start over in Africa, if you want to. We'll start over there. The exporters like Sudan, they love China. Same reason, let's move to Southwest Asia. Iran loves China. It's another exporter of crude and natural gas. China pays money, and China also provides you with political protection because it has a permanent seat and a veto on the UN Security Council. They're quite popular there. There are other little countries. I'm not quite sure what the status is now. Maybe Jim can chime in on this on Equatorial Guinea, but I do know there are a couple of other West African countries. Well, I know it's oil there.
It's all natural resources. Cambodia is unusual because they haven't got a lot of anything at the moment.
Well, but Chinese arms also tend to show up when the Chinese buy oil from you. The Angolans like the Chinese because they're helping rebuild the main railroad out into the middle of Angola, and doing a good job of it, and they spend money, and they also provide you with some degree of political protection. And Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, has worked out a deal. Oh, it's to China's benefit, really more, I think, than it is to the Congolese. But what's new about that? The Chinese are going to build infrastructure, which Congo needs. They will largely bring in their own workers, which is the way the Chinese work, and then the Chinese get a right to extract minerals, useful minerals out of the Congo. So they're popularly there with a bunch of extremely suspect regimes in Africa. I've already mentioned Iran in Southwest Asia. Those are their friends. They aren't quite in the same league as with Jim's great headline, buying Cambodia, but you can see how the support is purchased, and you also see the quid pro quo. You see the money and political support, and then China gets raw materials, minerals, and energy from these nations. Well, so they like them, Dan. Now let's move to out in the Indian Ocean. India doesn't like China. As a matter of fact, about 6 weeks ago, last class at the University of Texas, when I taught my strategy seminar, I had Al Nothi show up, and one of the things we discussed is India and China's relationship. And Dr. Nothi told my students, hey, there are far more deeper, long-term disagreements between India and China than there are between China and the United States. And that was one of those moments you heard the proverbial hush and blink, blink, and I stepped in and said, now, you don't hear that in the media, do you? But that's tomorrow's news today, or the news in 17 years. You heard it today. I said, but this is old news, folks. 1962, Sino-Indian War. Resolved for the most part. There are still disagreements over where that Himalayan border should be, but just because that war is resolved, the competition between the two Asian giants, China and India, is extraordinary. And China looks at the Indian Ocean and sees India, which has a good navy and has blue water capabilities. It's modeled itself after the Royal Navy and the U.S. Navy. And India sits on China's lines of communication from Southwest Asia and Africa. So China's got troubles with India. India doesn't like China, and both of them have nuclear weapons. So there's one of your answers. Your big competitor with China right there is India. Now I'll just, without going blow by blow, you want to look at relationships with the Philippines and Vietnamese over, the traditional enmity that Jim touched on between the Vietnamese and Chinese, one of the things that led to the four modernizations. There were already in progress. You can look back and say Zhou Enlai is the one who suggested it, but the war between Vietnam and China in 1979, the Vietnamese knocked the heck out of the Chinese, and in that short war likely killed 20,000 Chinese soldiers. It convinced China that they weren't up to a battle with anyone if they couldn't win a war with Vietnam on their own border. But there's competition over the South China Sea, Spratly Islands. You'll see us write about them on the strategy page so often. There could be oil deposits. Not good.
That's been going on since the end of World War II or even
Yes. And there's been sparring between China and Vietnam over it. But you asked me, and so let me just go on. We're not even not just lightly touch on Taiwan, you know. Lost province, separate country, nationalists versus communists. Relationships with South Korea? Well, if North Korea is your best ally up there, and yet South Korea is what, I think, third largest trading partner after Japan and the United States?
Yes. Much bigger than North Korea.
Oh, no. It's much bigger than, South Korea is a modern country. Yep. South Korea economically and politically won the Korean War. They just haven't the military angle in over, and in part because China continues to back up North Korea. Japanese-Chinese relationship, interesting. Japanese want to trade with the Chinese. Chinese find it beneficial, but the enmity there goes deep. And then the Chinese view, and this is something after I finish my little tour, and I'll do it as quickly as possible. Jim can talk about how the Chinese view the Japanese Navy and the relationship with the Japanese Navy and U.S. Navy. It's very tight. Let's move on. Mongolia. Hates being caught between China and Russia and wants a relationship with the United States, Russia preferable to China. Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, if China's interested in any minerals Afghanistan might have, But they're sensitive about the Xinjiang province out in the west-northwest, because that's where the Uyghurs live. And that's the Uyghurs were enlisted by Al-Qaeda. They've got issues there with the Muslims. And then swing it on the south. Okay, they get along somewhat with Burma. They can buy Burma. But we've already talked about the relationship with India, exacerbated by the fact that Mao absorbed Tibet into communist China in, what, 1950? Of course, he was just doing what he said the emperors used to control Tibet, so communist emperors are going to control Tibet as well. And then move on back to Vietnam, which Vietnam, the irony of the Vietnam War is that Vietnam desperately seeks a strategic relationship with the United States. Because to counter the huge weight of China that's right there on their border. So, Dan, they got a lot, despite what you read on the front page of a lot of the major media, despite the touts you may read about, quote-unquote, China's great economic success and careful planning and the like, and I'm referring to a Tom Friedman column of not too long ago that was just It was mind-boggling to believe that he would believe China is a model for sustained and long-term planning. Does he know what goes on inside China? China's got a lot of enemies. China's got a lot of problems.
China's biggest problem is internal, because the thing that's going to cause them the most grief, is causing them the most grief, is the growing economy and the growing number of people entering what we would call the lower middle class, but in China it's the upper middle class, people who can buy a house, can buy a car, can buy a lot of appliances. This is considered, you know, luxury by Chinese standards, because most Chinese are still living in, you know, mud brick, you know, huts, as it were. But an increasing number, if they can get to the coast, they can get a job, get an education, they can become, by their standards, rich beyond, you know, their wildest dreams. The problem is this requires a lot of resources. It requires oil. It requires a lot of raw materials. And the Chinese do the math, and they realize that if too many Chinese achieve this goal, China's going to have serious problems obtaining these raw materials, which could lead to wars. I mean, wars have long been fought over access to raw materials, whether it's the Mongols looking for pasturage for their, you know, their millions of horses their armies require, or countries seeking coal or, you know, iron deposits along the French-German border. This could be an enormous problem. And the Chinese government really dances around it because it's so obvious. It's the elephant in the room nobody talks about.
Right. The other thing that I can't remember who the discussion was with, but apparently one of China's ministers was talking to one of our secretaries of state or commerce or something like that. And the minister said that what he wakes up and worries about every morning is the 100,000 new people that need jobs every month. And that they have a, you know, we talk about our unemployment levels. Their unemployment levels are extreme.
Yes, although there is a shortage in China of skilled labor. I mean, there are a lot of factories that can't basically fill all their jobs. Now, China has a very, you know, adequate, well, not adequate, you know, it's a complete education system in that 98% of the population is literate. But the higher education is a much more competitive matter. And in order to keep their economy growing at the rate it's been growing, what, 10% a year for almost 30 years now, they need more higher education, and that's expensive. That's one thing to teach people to read and write, but it's another matter to give them a technical or even, you know, trade, you know, type organization to be a machinist or something like that. You still need people like that.
Yeah.
And they have a shortage in that, and that shortage is going to grow. And they're tearing their hair out, you know, trying to figure, well, how are we going to pay for all this education? How are we going to decide who's going to get it? The Chinese communist police state is having an enormous problem maintaining the kind of control they're used to. And they're constantly having to adapt to losing a lot of that control. I mean, the internet scares them to death. And what happened with this recent Honda strike is, I mean, from what I've been hearing, you know, the bureaucrats are just ready to jump out windows. Because how the hell did they do that? They basically given up, well, not given up, but they know that they don't have the same degree of censorship, of control over the cell phone system as they do over the internet. And even the internet can be, you know, gotten around. But the cell phone system, you know, they have 400 million internet users, but they have nearly in the entire adult population, you know, over the age of 14 using cell phones. And so they have twice as many cell phone users out there, and this is the entirety of the Chinese population. And the fact that these people, factory workers, have become, you know, these geeks that the communist bureaucrats fear so much, that is really scary. Because there's no place to hide. You can't control, you know, an army of 800 million geeks.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. They've actually created concentration camps where they take quote-unquote internet and video addicts and put them in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, addiction is becoming a big problem. Well, right. Actually, all throughout East Asia, there was the South Korean couple who were arrested because they allowed their infant child to starve to death while they were playing video games. No, that is a problem which we thought we had it bad. You know, of course, we passed through this. Well, then we still have it. We just got used to it. But in the 1980s, there were the stories of kids, you know, flunking out of Yale, Harvard, and I'm sure Brigham Young University, because of the growing availability of online games. But it apparently hit East Asia, you know, even harder. And they were less equipped, you know, to deal with rebellious, you know, teenagers. You know, that's sort of something you have to learn to live with in the West. But in the East, it's something that is anathema. It's not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
But what really bothers the Chinese government, I mean, you know, rebellious kids getting addicted to video games, hell, you know, there's cocaine and opium and all sorts of other addictions around, too. And, well, sex is another one they've had to adapt to. But the idea of all these uneducated men and women walking around, you always see people walking down the street all over the world tapping on their cell phones. Well, what the hell? Well, they're not always just texting each other. They're basically learning new tricks to do with their increasingly powerful cell phones.
Right.
Smartphones are becoming enormously popular, and they're not just selling to the geeks.
Right.
They're selling to everybody.
One of the things is that my other company that we look at going into other markets and like that, and if you take a internet product into Asia, you actually have to go with a mobile platform.
Yeah.
Because that is how Asia uses the internet, is via their cell phones.
It's not only what everybody has, but even people who have computers spend a lot more time on their cell phones
right
than they do in the West.
Which is just uncontrollable for the Chinese government. There's just no way to control that at this point. The genie's out of the bottle on that one.
So the cell phone may eventually, you know, when the histories are written 100 years from now, this is what saved democracy.
Well, you know, there's. Have you ever heard the comment, Jim or Austin, that one of the things that helped the revolutionaries or the progressives inside of Russia to overthrow communism was the Xerox machine. Well, it was the Xerox machine.
Because before that they had what they call Samizdat, where people would simply copy forbidden books
right.
and pass around the handwritten you know, copies of these books. But yeah, once originally Xerox machines had to be equipped with a device that put a serial number on every copy so they could trace back. But of course people learned how to hack that, so to speak.
Yeah.
And before you know it, the bureaucrats loved the Xerox, the photocopying machines, not just the original Xerox, but Japan was selling the real cheap ones as time went by. And he started getting into Russia and more of them. And yeah, after a while, they were printing all these forbidden books. Who needs to sit down and type them out or, you know, write them out in longhand anymore?
And now you can just go up to the Gutenberg Project on the internet. And,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, yeah. Oh, yeah, well, that scares the Chinese, too. The free availability of forbidden writings on the internet. I mean, they've tried to adapt, and they've been fairly successful. For example, there was something, I don't think we've even reported this, but there was a recent story where a senior Chinese government bureaucrat talking to a audience, an auditorium full of journalism students. Now, this was a closed meeting, but the essence of it got out. And he was simply giving examples of how effective self-censorship works. He was telling us basically war stories of how the government contained certain stories that it wanted to contain, usually involving industrial disasters. I think there was one thing where, oh, yeah, one of the stories that the guy was particularly proud of was when one of the few Chinese astronauts came back in the capsule, you know, using the Russian system, and landed. There was a flaw in the capsule, and he was bleeding through the nose. I mean, he wasn't seriously injured, but he didn't look good. Doesn't look good, you know, when you open up the capsule, and here's the pilot's old blood. And what they did was, when they saw that, they said, all right, clean this guy up, close it again, let's run that again. And they went through it again, and they managed to keep only the approved version, you know, out there. Initially, anyway, I mean, eventually, you know, it leaked out. But when the news of that particular lecture got out, most Chinese simply shrugged their shoulders because they take it for granted that the government, any official government media is trying to spin you.
Right.
So what it comes down to is who's spinning who? You know, the bureaucrat and most of the students in the audience who are hoping to get jobs in the, you know, the conventional media, whether it be electronic or you know, print, simply said, well, yeah, this is the way it is. No, isn't that interesting how they did that? You know, they probably a perverse pride in how clever, you know, the government is and still being able to spin the media in this day and age. But at the same time, they're whistling past the graveyard because the whole media world is changing around them. You know, and they're liable to wake up one morning and realize that nothing works anymore. It's like happens to the newspaper business in the United States. Over the period of, what, 2 years, we've had over a dozen major newspapers, you know, in large cities go out of business. Many of them, others look at their books and realize they are in a hopeless situation. They need a miracle, you know, to survive the next few years. And then Orphan Annie goes out of syndication. I mean, the world is changing. And the Chinese are very much afraid of this. They started getting afraid in 1989 when communism collapsed in Eastern Europe and then followed by Russia. They said, how could this happen? One thing communism has delivered on in the 20th century was a perfected police state. In other words, a police state that works. And all of a sudden it didn't work anymore. And they realized there's basically a hidden flaw in this thing we've been worshiping for the last 50, 60 years. And now they find things are, you know, fixing the problem has become like, you know, chasing after a moving target. You fix something and it morphs.
Right.
It's not the same anymore.
Yeah.
And so they don't quite know what to do. So while people in the West worry about change, you know, it's not a matter of life and death. Because these bureaucrats in China, what they desperately fear is if there's a democracy comes along, they may be held to account. Because basically the Communist Party has an enormous amount of blood on its hands.
Right.
And if the Chinese people look for revenge, they're going to look for, well, hey, who are the current communists? All right, you're responsible. Up against the wall.
So, Austin, what do you think about the possibilities of China stirring up some sort of trouble to build nationalism inside the country to get the country refocused on a outside issue? Maybe China gets involved in a small war or something like that.
I don't know. Dan, what makes you think they're going to do that all the time? They do that all the time.
I mean, right.
Taiwan / Republic of China is when they need a burst of national enthusiasm, they threaten another missile drizzle on Taiwan. That is one way that they use that kind of nationalistic tool. Another way they do it, though, politically and diplomatically, is setting themselves up in opposition to the United States. They certainly play to that as they can play their role it plays well not only with certain parts of China's domestic audience, but also certainly with, well, with some of the fantastic governments that I mentioned earlier, Congo, Zimbabwe, particularly Sudan, Iran, when China stands up to quote-unquote what is U.S. Perceived as U.S. Hegemony. I don't know if you remember the term that actually was the Chinese who were always talking about hegemony from the Soviet Union, and the term was, a joke became hegemony cricket is what was being played. Well, see, the hegemony cricket is the United U.S. And the post-Cold War world, and so China does that in both the political diplomatic realm. As for making trouble, remember, making that kind of trouble is a two-edged. Goodness, how many edges can you cram onto a blade? This is an ugly sharpened mace. If I'm going to use a metaphor like that, because there's so much trouble that everyone on everyone's border there in East Asia and Central Asia can make if someone starts games like that. It's something that China certainly has. I'd be interested in Jim's comment on this. Some of the Navy games that China has played both with Japan and the United States along the littoral, the Western Pacific littoral, those can have nationalism appeal to nationalism, showing China's growing might. Certainly, that was done during that accident. Remember with the
right.
P-3 Ares craft in the spring, April, I think, of 2001. Am I getting the date right on that? We can always go check it.
Yeah.
That component was there, even though what happened, it was the Chinese pilot's fault for not having, if he's going to get up there and ride the guy's wing, you better have some skills, and he didn't have them. What was rather amazing was the pilot, Navy pilot, that saved that plane. But then we had this national incident, and, quote-unquote, U.S. downing of a Chinese jet, and capture of a U.S. reconnaissance aircraft spying on us, and the like. That was not a, I think it was clearly a mishap. Chinese didn't want to man their aircraft slamming into American aircraft, but that is how that incident played out. Here is something, though, that I don't know what my real limit on this is, but China has, after its confrontation with Google, which was January and February through March of this year, and finally, kicking Google out, Google moves its operation to Hong Kong, has that was the kind of confrontation that China, Chinese the leadership reflecting many of the fears that Jim spoke to a moment ago about the technology and what the Chinese people can now know, and not just what they know, but what they can say, and why the communist authorities want to stop them from saying that and know who is saying what within it. But at the same time, that was something that cost them politically. And it's they haven't figured out that they don't look nationalistic. They look and strong. They look frightened when they get into it with an internet company like Google. So as for again making the trouble that you suggest, I've shown how they do it. I think it's unlikely to do stir a pot like that, because they know their own pot can be stirred, and Google is one of the sticks.
Well,
yeah, the Chinese play it smart. They usually don't pick a fight that they don't already know they can win. And the one with Google was surprising, because they thought they could bully Google, and Google said no. And as Mr. Brin, one of the two founders of Google, pointed out, he grew up as a young child in Soviet Russia, and even though he was a little kid, 6 years old, when he left, it always stuck with him. His parents obviously always reflected the the chagrin, the unhappiness of living under such a restrictive, you know, environment, a dictatorship like that. And that's what really, you know, caused Google. You know, Brin said, hey, you know, our motto was supposed to be don't be evil, and we've been making deals with the devil here. And,
right.
And let me see, what happened to me when I was a kid? Oh, yeah, screw you, China. And China basically backed off. They said, all right, you can go to Hong Kong, but it's nothing. It's meaningless. You know, that more Chinese than ever can get access to uncensored search, you know, via Google. And China just went quiet about it. They said, all right, let's not say discuss this anymore, please, because they've been defeated.
Dan, let me make a comment about this. So here you hear Jim and me both taking the tack on China's troubles and China's issues, and in part because they aren't they're covered in, let's say, the specialty press. I mean, Strategy Page being an example of that. They tend to be glossed over, except in extreme situations, in most mainstream coverage. I mean, I got to credit the Associated Press, ran a couple of very informative stories on some of the ancillary issues between Uyghur workers in southeastern China and Han Chinese after the Uyghur riots and the near revolt in Uyghur autonomous district in northwestern China. So those they do get covered. Some of the things Jim mentioned about the labor strikes, labor unrest, it does come out. Sometimes it comes out via Hong Kong. Hong Kong press takes a little while, but sometimes it does get picked up by and mentioned by some of the wire services. There is a positive read on China as the fact that they are still a dictatorship and a communist dictatorship at their core has got to be emphasized. And yet at the same time, since the mid 1970s, and definitely after 1980, when Deng Xiaoping's reforms, China has progressed remarkably economically. Now, there's a dirty deal in that, is that you accept the communist government and you can get rich, but if you oppose the communist government, then you'll pay a price. That's part of the dirty deal. But the communist Chinese are riding a tiger, to use an old metaphor, and that is more money and more knowledge in the hands of the people, ultimately at some point translates into a demand for greater personal decision-making power, which means, you know, of course, greater personal freedom. They've had an extraordinary number of successes. I'll say this, as well, to point it out, China is a pretty easy and safe place for visitors to travel. The Chinese want foreign visitors to come as tourists and see China. They're after it both as a business, but at the same time also to showcase some of they're proud of their achievements, and they should be. And that's important, Dan, to be able to, you know, travel safely. There really aren't a lot of places on the planet you can do it, and the Chinese make an effort to do it. This is a significant change from the past when they were a closed society. But at the same time, to portray China, as has been done, unfortunately, by some American leaders and some of the American press, as a nation that is successful in long-term planning or has all these, you know, strengths going on, without recognizing all of the enormous problems and the way that the costs that are involved with what looks like their successful decision-making and planning process is wrong to do as well.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, you know, China is going to continue to be in the news and making news and like that. So I'm sure we'll be talking again about them probably in another 6 months. It seems like that's when they pop up on our radar every so often. We've run out of time. Yeah.
China is living the great Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. China's in interesting times.
Yep, they are. We'll talk to you guys next time. Bye.
Bye.